Please be seated. Good morning. We have three cases for oral argument today. We're delighted to welcome Irish barrister Dolores Keane, who has accompanied attorneys Joe Owens and Deborah Reidel, and you are attending the 9:45 and 10:45 in the morning arguments. Barrister Keane, and where are you, where do you reside? Well, we want to welcome you here, and we have visited your city and country and greatly enjoyed the trip. With our special guest recognized and noted, and we do want to thank you for coming, and want to thank counsel for bringing her. And do you have a summary of the two cases we're about to hear? Fine, that makes it easier to do that. And I don't know what the your courts are doing these days, but oral argument here is limited. And traditionally, they were not in common law of Great Britain. So. You will notice our light system that attempts to do that, but the light system is for the attorneys, not for the judges, as you will see. So let me call the first case, 10 AP 1639, State versus Eric O. Maggott. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Maggott is Andrew Hinkle. Mr. Hinkle, Assistant State Public Defender.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In this case, Mr. Maggett pled not guilty by reason of mental disease or defect, but the Circuit Court didn't let him testify or present evidence to the jury on it. Instead, the Court dismissed the defense and found him guilty. Now, this procedure
is that true, Mr. Hinkle? When I read this, it seemed to me that the record indicates, and I'm asking you, what does the record show about any kind of cumulative nature of the evidence that Mr. Maggett proposed to put on? And how would that have factored into Judge Curry's decision to proceed to a directed verdict?
Well, what Judge Curry elicited, I think, was counsel's description, rough description of what Mr. Maggett would testify to, if allowed to testify.
And wasn't what he said was going to happen basically the same thing that had already, the same information that had already been delivered, that he had blacked out and didn't recall any of the events?
And it's important to recall that this discussion that's being had was being had in the context of the judge saying, well, you need to have medical expert testimony in order to put on an NGI defense, in order to prove an NGI defense. Yes, it is true that counsel said, well, he said he blacked out. Yes, it is true that counsel said that he was out of it, I think, with her exact words and his exact words. But I don't think that we can draw from that that his testimony, Mr. Maggett's testimony, at the second phase was going to be exactly the same as that which he presented in the first phase. It could well have been, he could have elaborated more. It could have been somewhat, it could have been slightly different. There's no requirement that he was to testify exactly as he had previously. So the court dismissed the defense, didn't let him put on his testimony. This procedure, as I said, isn't part of the NGI statutes, and as I just said, the substance of the court's ruling, which was that a defendant is required to provide medical expert testimony in order to put on an NGI defense, was incorrect. Counsel was correct about the substance of the law on that. It says so right there in Leach. So What the state is arguing, the state is essentially, I don't think, taking the position that he was required to present medical expert testimony. What the state is instead required, or pardon me, arguing, is that any error in refusing to let him put on his case was harmless. Essentially, it doesn't matter that he didn't get to testify because he would have been convicted. There are two problems with this theory. First, he didn't get to put on his evidence. In order to find harmless...
Could you get a little closer to your microphone or move it up,
should
please?
Should I move it? Is that...
You can raise the whole podium, counsel, if you like. Sometimes that's
on the right side, there's a button.
Here comes our trusty marshal. He'll fix it for you. I think he's a little bit too tall for where the podium is.
That's it. Thank you.
I'm sure your argument is so powerful that you want me to hear every word.
Thank you. There's two problems with the theory. First, it requires the court to fill in the evidence that was never put on. The standard for harmless error, the burden is on the state, and it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And I don't think that by speculating or arguing or making inferences about what Mr. Majette would have said, we can meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that the state is required to meet. And second of all, it continues to be our position that the evidence that he had already put on during the guilt phase was sufficient to get to the jury on the question of his mental responsibility. And in order to find otherwise, this court has to either discredit his testimony or it has to construe it in a way that is least helpful to Mr. Majette. And that's not the harmless error standard, and that's not the role of this court.
Mr. Hinkle, let me ask you this. It's my understanding that in the second phase that the defendant has the burden of proof. It's my understanding that the defendant in the second phase has to establish that there was a mental disease or defect that is within the statute, that it's a mental disease or defect that qualifies under the statute. Now, how does blacking out or out of it qualify as a mental disease or defect? That's the first step that the defendant has to establish in the second phase. Tell me how that fits with I blacked out or I was out of it.
Certainly. First of all, mental disease or defect, as this court is aware, is not a medical term. It's a legal term, and it's not bound by the medical labels. In this case, being out of it, which I read as being having some sort of impairment of consciousness, I think as a matter of common sense and just as a matter of logic, is a mental defect that qualifies under the statute. And in fact, this court in Sprague has said that a person whose consciousness is absent or impaired can qualify, that condition can qualify as a mental disease or defect. In Sprague, the defendant committed a homicide. He also drove a car, made a couple of phone calls, was in a police chase, and he was found guilty by the jury in the first phase, and he was allowed to put on his NGI case in the second phase. The fact that he had been found guilty by the jury wasn't enough for him not to be able to put on his NGI case, where he said, hey, effectively, I was out of it.
Well, according to the trial transcript, defense counsel argued that mental disease or defect under the statute included substantial disorder of thought, mood, memory, orientation, or perception. And those words come from the cases?
Well, those are actually found in, I believe, in Chapter 51. That's the definition. It's provided at some place in Chapter 51 to describe what it is to be mentally ill, which is, of course, an issue in those cases. There is a jury instruction comment suggesting that that is also or can be an appropriate standard for an NGI, a 971-17, 971-165 NGI decision. There is the statement in Leach that the state has seized onto, and I think the Court of Appeals referred to as well, saying, well, evidence of lack of memory, episodic amnesia, is not evidence of of a mental disease or defect. But if you look at Leach in the context in which this court said that, it's clear, it's toward the end, it's one of the last paragraphs, and it's from the testimony of a Dr. Crowley, who was one of the experts that testified in that case. And he said, well, you know, in my expert opinion, simply being unable to remember things is not indicative of a mental disease or defect. And the court repeats that. I think it's clear from the context that that's simply a discussion of the evidence that was in that case. I don't think it makes sense in general to say, well, the fact that you can't remember something or the fact that you don't remember something that you would expect to remember is not evidence of some sort of mental abnormality. I think as a matter of just common sense, the opposite is true.
Counselor, isn't there more to it than just identifying some kind of a mental disease or defect? Doesn't it have to be one that alters the defendant's ability to conform his conduct?
That's correct. It has to either render it impossible, he has to lack the substantial ability to either conform his conduct to the requirements of law or to appreciate the wrongfulness of conduct.
Right. And I think, you know, the question that Justice Crooks asked you is the one that troubles me, but I think you gave him part of an answer because you talked about blacking out or being out of it and you thought was a mental disease or defect. Now I'd like you to tie that up to what you are required to do under the statute so that you have a qualifying condition. Can you do that for me and why?
So you're asking about the second half?
Yeah, uh-huh. I am. Thanks.
Yeah. Well, I think I said this in the briefing, that a person who is lacking consciousness certainly is, first of all, unable to appreciate the wrongfulness of his or her conduct or anything else. That's what lack of consciousness means. You're not appreciating what's going on. Even a substantially impaired consciousness, which might not rise to the level of complete blackout, we can imagine how a jury would say, well, this person is not truly responsible for their actions because they couldn't appreciate what was wrong and they couldn't really control themselves. They couldn't conform their conduct to the requirements of law. I think that's my answer.
So you're arguing that he blacked out even though he was moving around and talking to people. I'm having trouble putting them together, I guess.
Yeah, I understand that. However, as I said, in Sprague, that was exactly what was going on. In fact, the defendant in Sprague did things that are, I think, more complicated than what happened here. There's certainly examples that we all understand. I'm not suggesting that Mr. Manchette was sleepwalking, but people do things that they don't know that they're doing. It's not impossible. It may be something that the jury would not believe, but that's a question of credibility. And, of course, the jury never got to hear, never got to decide.
Describe for me a circumstance where you court would be correct in not having a trial on the mental disease or defect portion.
Well, I don't think that the statute authorizes that at all.
The directing a verdict statute or?
Well, again, a directed verdict involves actually having the evidence. I think that so the procedure that the court undertook here, I don't think is correct under any circumstances.
So a court is always, there is no circumstance under which a court could avoid the second phase. A court always must have a trial, even if,
where there's a timely plea entered. I mean, there are the cases that were cited by the state.
Well, assume there's a timely plea, but your proposition is that the court must always conduct the second phase.
I think the court must always give the defendant the opportunity to put on a case. Now, that doesn't mean that any kind of evidence is admissible, that it's total free reign, just like any other testimony or any other evidence. There are all sorts of objections that are available, relevance, hearsay, et cetera, et cetera. But in this case, just having kind of an ad hoc discussion with counsel, hey, what are you going to put on? That's not good enough because you have to have medical expert testimony. No, I don't think that's authorized under any circumstances.
Do you think if the court would have put on the second part, let the defendant replay the evidence that the defendant was going to replay, and then directed verdict, that you'd be standing here today?
Well, it depends on what was said. It depends what the evidence was. Would I be standing here? I suppose that's up to the court.
Maybe I'm wrong. I thought defense counsel said there was nothing new. He was just going to be putting in the same evidence again.
Well, again, I think there's some ambiguity in her discussion of exactly what she was saying. Was she saying he's going to say exactly the same thing? I think that's how the state would like to read the transcript. That's not how I would like to read the transcript. And, of course, the burden to show harmless error is on the state, and it's not on Mr. Minjet to show that there was error.
Okay, but so you dispute that the Court of Appeals in that regard as well? Because the Court of Appeals seemed to indicate there was nothing new that would have been put on.
Right, yes, I do disagree with that.
Okay, and where in the record does that support your, where exactly do you find your support for the fact that there would have been something else done?
Well, I guess what my position is that she sort of summarized what he was going to say, and that it's not reasonable to jump from her quick summary when she was arguing about something else to the conclusion that that's literally those six words were the only things that he was going to say on the stand.
Okay. So then counsel said, no, Judge, that's not it. I'm going to put in more than that.
No, she did not say that. I'm not suggesting that.
Okay.
Does the video, was there anything new or additional about the videotape that was going to be presented?
No. There's one video.
Does the videotape completely support the testimony of Mr. Maggette?
I guess I'm not quite sure what the question about that.
Are there any inconsistencies between Mr. Maggette's testimony and the objective videotape?
Not that I'm aware of. I haven't seen it in quite some time.
I think maybe what Justice Prosser is getting at, and I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but your client's saying, I blacked out. I was just out of it. And yet, doesn't the videotape itself show that he was very much involved in what was going on with the officers?
Oh, I don't mean to suggest that he was asleep or that his eyes were closed. I think it's quite clear from the video that that's not the case. What I mean to suggest is that, you know, you can't tell what's going on in someone's head by looking at their face, which is something that this court, of course, said in Leach. I certainly don't think that the video provides definitive evidence of his mental state any one way or the other. I don't think it could.
Blacking out and not remembering what happened does happen to people, and that they will perform a function at a friend. I don't mean to testify on behalf of your client, counsel, who was in an airport, got off the plane, 3.5 hours later was in the airport and didn't know what happened in the 3.5 hours, but wasn't unconscious, wasn't lying on the ground, was obviously doing something in the airport, and had absolutely no recollection of what was done in that time span. And that's a total memory loss for a very short time. Obviously, friend had her so checked into the hospital quite quickly on return home. But I think that's what seems to be trying to show. Whether you could show that, I have no idea. But
that's exactly right. I'm not suggesting that he was asleep during the incident. He obviously was not. However, what we have that tends to show that is his testimony. Now, again, there was evidence that tended to militate against his testimony, but that is not what courts do in cases where there are jury trials. They don't determine whether evidence outweighs other evidence. They don't determine whether to believe someone like Mr. Maggette. That's up to the jury.
Where is there anything in the record to support what the chief just went through? Was there an expert or something? I missed it. If there was someone that was going to come in and say, this is what happened to him, he didn't know what was going on. He was kind of sleepwalking through this. He was really, in all effects, blacked out. Or was that just the video that then you could argue that? I'm not getting where anything supports what the chief just said in this record. Was there something there that I'm missing?
There wasn't going to be an expert saying that was what had happened. It was simply, as I said, Mr. Maggette saying that was what had happened. Now, of all of the possible witnesses in the world as to what was going on inside Mr. Maggette's head, obviously he's one of the few who can talk about that.
Is this considered a civil or a criminal procedural issue at this phase of the trial?
It's a hybrid, frankly. Obviously, it's part of a criminal trial. It's the second part of this criminal trial. The burden is a civil one that we typically associate with civil law. The defendant does have some of the same rights that we associate with criminal law, so I guess I can't say one or the other. It's really kind of both.
Okay. And it's a 5-6 verdict.
Pardon? Yes. Five, six. One way or the other, I believe.
I read the transcript of the second part of this trial, and if I were defense counsel, I'd certainly want a stronger transcript. Because counsel did not make the kind of argument, or give an example such as I made, where the only one who can say that 3 hours is not accountable, or 10 minutes, or whatever it is the one who experienced it, and either you believe it or you don't. And my example in the airport, there's no reason not to believe it. Now, if I added other things, you might say, well, she's faking it. But what you have is the trial judge is very worried about the weather. And I sure appreciate that, because it's a heavy storm coming in, and they've got a jury, and everyone's going to want to get home, including the judge and staff. And then you have a debate with between the judge and the and defense counsel about whether you need an expert witness. You think the trial court erred on that?
I do.
Okay. And you have some cases, and we'll hear from the state. And then you think that. You have a directed verdict after evidence. I think that's generally true. And according to the statute, you do it on motion. And here the judge made his own motion. So one of the issues is, can you have a directed verdict without a motion of counsel?
Again, I guess, first of all, I think I made myself clear that I don't think it was a directed verdict.
I looked at the bench book, and the way I read the bench book, if you do something before all the evidence is in, they tend to think it's a summary judgment, a partial summary judgment.
Sure.
It's a matter of law. There's nothing here. Directed verdict is after the evidence is in, then you take the issue away from the jury.
Right.
So, but, you know, that's a name in the court, whether the court phrased the right, the result is the same. Judge wouldn't let it go to the jury, whether you call it directed verdict or summary judgment. Right.
Right. And of course, in summary.
Excuse me, go ahead, finish with it.
I was just going to say that in the case of an actual summary judgment, which is not applicable in a criminal case. There are cases saying that.
Well, that's one of the reasons for asking whether it's criminal or civil, right?
Sure, I understand that. However, this was not a summary judgment either. In a summary judgment, there are all sorts of procedural requirements that ensure, effectively, that parties have the opportunity to get their, you know, evidentiary ducks in a row, and that the court has a full opportunity to consider the evidence before it, and that a full record is made for review.
My question was going to refer back to the use of an expert witness for this part of the trial. Is it your position that whatever the defendant's argument is in regard to why he fits within the statute, that he can testify about a mental disease or defect and himself tie it to the inability to conform his conduct?
Sure. Yeah, I think, first of all, because it's not a medical definition, lay testimony is appropriate to meet both prongs.
Why doesn't every single defendant, then, that has an NGI trial use this as one of their defenses? I blacked out. I don't remember a thing about it.
I guess I don't know the answer to that. I think in a lot of instances, a jury might not believe it. And in this case, the jury might not have believed Mr. Majette, but we don't know.
To me, it seems like a connection that you would need some other testimony to support. I mean, if he had someone that was going to come in and testify, this is not unknown in medical science, that people can black out, they can talk, they can experience things that to you and I look like they're present, but they're just not really mentally participating. If that kind of a foundation had been laid for it by him, then I wouldn't be so uncomfortable with what you're telling me. But without that kind of a foundation, I don't know. I mean, isn't it just flip of the coin whether the jury believes it or doesn't? That's no standard.
Well, it's a question of credibility. I mean, I'm not sure
it's a question of credibility. I don't see where you have foundation to raise the argument.
Well, I think that your question presumes that without an expert saying that this is possible, that it must be impossible. But I don't think that that's a legal principle in these cases.
No, that's not exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying that the jury has to base their decision on objectively identifiable facts. You don't want them flipping a coin. You certainly don't want them doing that, and I don't want them doing that. So without a psychiatrist or somebody else, doesn't have to be a psychiatrist, but someone that has experience in this that can come in and testify, similar to the example that the Chief Justice gave about she's heard about people showing up at an airport 3 hours later and not knowing what's gone on, without giving the jury this information, I don't know what basis they have to believe your client.
Again, I think that what my client says, the weighing of whether that's true or not, whether they believe that he was unconscious when this incident occurred, is a question of his credibility.
But I don't see how they can weigh his credibility when they don't have anything to weigh it against. That's what I'm trying to say to you. I don't think there's a foundation.
Well, that goes back to the question whether you need an expert witness to agree with that.
It goes back to having laid a foundation to raise the defense you're raising. I mean, you know foundational objections come out throughout the trial. I'm sure you have made a lot yourself. I know when I was on your side of the street, I certainly made a lot because sometimes opposing counsel hasn't thought about that. But I'm having trouble with the foundation. That's kind of what's bothering me.
Sure. I guess when my response is that when you look at the words of the statute, what's required to show NGI, these are all terms and experiences that a person can describe for themselves. And it's as much, as this court has said, it's as much a moral judgment for the jury whether someone was in a mental place that they should be responsible for their actions as it is a scientific one. I mean, the science changes.
Thank you.
May I ask, when did Mr. Majette black out?
Well, his testimony was, I think, it was just for a few seconds.
Beg your pardon?
Just for a few seconds, right near the beginning of the incident.
Just for a few seconds?
I believe that's what the testimony was.
How long did the whole incident take?
Well, it depends how you define it, but
from the time they started at his cell.
From the time they opened the door and run in, yep. From the time that he's subdued, it's a few more seconds, but I don't know, 20 seconds, something like that.
Well, now, as I understand it, I haven't seen the video. He took off some of his clothes and was in and assumed a boxing stance, is that right?
Yes.
Did he have his mental faculties then?
Well, I think according to his testimony, yes. And, I mean, again, I appreciate how evidence of him having planned to do something like what he did tends to undermine his contention that, hey, you know, I was out of it. However, again, if it's contradictory, if it undermines his credibility, that's a question for the jury.
It's possible, then, for someone to have an NGI defense to the commission of a crime when their so-called condition lasted only a couple of seconds?
Well, I think so long as it coincided with the crime at issue, the actus reus, then yes.
Did the defendant claim self-defense?
No, there was not a self-defense plea. I mean, it's... inherent in kind of some of the testimony that that's how he may have felt about it at times. But no.
You have not touched the issue of harmless error, counsel. So you might consider that in your 5 minutes of a rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I will.
Thank you. Eileen Prey, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin. Ms. Prey.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The state's contention is that a simple allegation that the defendant blacked out just isn't enough to prove a mental disease and defect, and that that mental disease and defect caused the person to not appreciate the wrongfulness of their actions, conduct, or to conform their conduct to the law. I agree with Justice Rogensack. If that were true, everybody would say, I blacked out. That's just not enough. It's true that you don't need an actual medical expert, and that experts may disagree, and that the labels aren't appropriate. But you need more than an allegation of somebody blacking out, particularly when all of the evidence that went on in the guilt phase, which was going to be repeated in the sanity phase, demonstrated that he didn't black out. Now, Attorney Hinkle has said, well, this kind of balancing of the weight of the evidence or making credibility determinations is for a jury to decide and not the court. But there are times when evidence is so incredible that it's incredible as a matter of law.
I want to counsel, and it is this issue of credibility that gets me into some analytical difficulty on harmless error, okay? Mm-hmm. In the arguments for harmless error, and indeed in your brief, before you get to harmless error, you say, assuming there was error.
Correct.
Right, and that's we do this all the time. But what that means is, assuming that there was some credible evidence to support the defendant's contention.
Okay, I'm going to answer your question, but I just want to make sure there's not a misunderstanding here in my harmless error argument. I am not arguing that if the judge was wrong on the merits of finding that there was no reasonable jury could find that this person had a mental disease or defect. If the judge was wrong about that, I'm not arguing that that was harmless. I'm arguing only that the timing of the decision, if you find that the court was required to go through the sanity phase before directing a verdict, instead of using a sort of semi-summary judgment, if that's the error that you're talking about, then I'm saying that's harmless because it was clear the kind of evidence that was going to be put on from the offer of proof.
It is, I think, a matter of focus. Let me start with an answer to...
And I know I didn't answer your question because I didn't quite understand it.
Okay. I'll back up and try to make myself a little clearer. Justice Ziegler asked a question about is there ever a time of opposing counsel that you can take the case before any evidence is presented in NGI?
Mm-hmm.
As I understand, and as the Court of Appeals understands the defense argument, it is, there is no Wisconsin authority under which a circuit court may direct a verdict after the guilt phase of an NGI trial, but before the mental responsibility phase. That's their position.
Correct.
Your position, as I understand it, is that there is no Wisconsin authority expressly prohibiting a court from
dismissing an NGI before the mental responsibility phase. Now I get to the important part. Where there is no credible evidence in support of the defense.
Correct.
So if there is no credible evidence, the court can not take, cannot, does not have to proceed to the NGI portion of the
That's our
case.
Position, yes.
Yeah, that's okay. So no credible evidence. But in order to get to harmless error, you have to assume there is credible evidence, don't you? You have to assume.
That's only if the harmlessness is because of the on the based on the merits.
Oh, see, that's what I say. It's a matter of focus. Was he harmed here because he was not able to put in any testimony? I mean, it seems to me that is a harm, that he was not able to put on a case.
I do not believe so, because he made an offer of proof that said, what I am going to say is what I said, I mean, the attorney did, obviously, what is going to be submitted is what was said in the guilt phase and what was on the videotape. And when you're talking about, I want to make clear, too, that I'm not saying there was any weighing of credible evidence here. The evidence that was put in the guilt phase, and it was used to try to say that he didn't intend to do the battery, was incredible as a matter of law, because it, first of all, I think there's two ways that something can be incredible as a matter of law. One, it doesn't comply with the laws of nature, and secondly, it conflicts with conceded facts. And he conceded a whole lot of things that don't say that he blacked out.
I'm talking about analysis now.
Okay.
And in a harmless error analysis, you are assuming that the court committed an error.
Correct.
You are assuming that the court committed an error by not allowing testimony after the guilt phase of an NGI trial, but before the mental responsibility phase. I didn't articulate that correctly.
The way I see our harmless error argument is it's sort of a but-for thing. The error that is complained of is that the court directed the verdict before the sanity phase instead of after.
I am
saying that it is beyond a reasonable doubt that if the court had allowed Majette to testify as he said he was going to and replay the same videotape, it is beyond a reasonable doubt that the court would have directed the verdict and would have been correct in doing that.
But you have to acknowledge, in order to get into the harmless error analysis, that there is, I'm assuming that there is some credible evidence. That's what your assumption is. I'm assuming that there was error, but it was harmless. So you are saying, I'm assuming that there is some credible evidence, and that's the error, but it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. Is that right?
I don't think I'm saying that. And maybe I'm just not following you, but...
Well, if you thought there was no error, you never have to get to harmless error.
Correct. And I'm not claiming that there is an error.
Don't you think there was an error when the judge said you got to have a medical witness? That was error.
That was, yes, an error, but that I don't think was the whole reason that he denied it. I think he was just like, there has to be more. And I agree with him. There has to be more than just an allegation that you blacked out when the testimony that Majette gave in the guilty phase says, I remember hitting them. I did it in self-defense. I planned it. I was upset with the guards. I knew that they would come and extract me. I was willing to take the consequences. That certainly doesn't show that he didn't know it was wrong and he couldn't control himself. That he
covered his window to get the guards to come and extract him. When they asked him three times, can we do anything to make you come out of the cell voluntarily? He says no. He puts cream on the floor to slow them down. He purposefully stands on the mattress so that he won't fall down. He takes his shirt off. He's in a boxer stance. They come in, and it takes maybe 2 seconds of when he says he's blacked out, and he's going like this, and that's when he says he's blacked, conveniently blacked out. That is incredible on its
face.
But,
counsel, I'm not sure that's the end of the story. The Court of Appeals, at page 4 of its decision, indicated that during the confrontation, that the testimony from Mr. Majette indicates that during the confrontation that he came in and out of recollection, because he was, you kind of ended at the start of the confrontation, but the relevant testimony that the Court of Appeals saw fit to put in its opinion was that, what do you remember? I don't know. I pretty much blacked out. And then we go down a few lines. What happened in your mind? Answer, we all are locked up. That's all I remember. All right, and did you hear your name being yelled? No. No, but at some point you stopped resisting. Is that correct? Answer, yeah, as soon as they put hands on me, that's when I stopped. What do you mean, put? Answer, soon as they, like, got a hold on to me. Question, okay. Well, answer, that's when I, like, put my hands up and stopped. And I suppose that is the basis for why you would argue that there is sufficient indication to indicate that the trial court made the determination correctly, as the Court of Appeals held, because the testimony is that he blacked out and was out of it for part of the confrontation, which by definition means that for part of the confrontation he was not.
That's true, too. And I hope you do get a chance to look at the video, because it literally, the critical period, which is this flurry, literally takes 1-2 seconds. And he's very calm and collected beforehand, ready, and then he's very calm and follows their directions. The other thing,
the jury saw the video 3 or 4 times, right?
Oh, many times,
okay.
Yes.
And here's what I'm trying to figure out. How does the NGI phase and the defense that's being put forth in the NGI phase, or the proposition that he's NGI, how do you reconcile that with the second element of this particular offense, which is that the jury, in order to find him guilty, had to conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that he intentionally caused bodily harm to this prison employee, and that intent, as the court defined it for them, meant that the defendant had the mental purpose to cause bodily harm to another human being, or was aware that his conduct was practically certain to cause bodily harm to another human being.
I don't think it can be reconciled. I mean, the jury found it was an intentional act. Mr. Majette used the same evidence that he intended to use in the insanity phase to try to counteract the idea that it was intentional. This sort of goes against the whole idea of a bifurcated trial in cases like Steele, where there's supposed to be some different kind of evidence that is put in the sanity phase than in the guilt phase. It's not supposed to be a repeat of the guilt phase, and that's exactly what he was going to do.
Did he argue in the guilt phase that he didn't mean to hurt that individual?
He said he blacked out and he was out of it, and I believe there was some argument in the closing arguments that means it wasn't an intentional act, but the jury didn't buy it.
I asked a question about defending himself, and I think you said he said he was defending himself.
He did.
Self-defense.
He did.
Okay. Is there an inconsistency between what he said and the video?
The video goes by really fast, and I do think it's not up to – it's up to the trial court to determine any kind of facts from the video. But when the issue is whether he lost consciousness or not, I think it's very clear, again, from the video that he did not. There wasn't any evidence of a loss of consciousness. And it went, again, very, very fast. Was that your question? I mean, again, the self-defense, that's really not an issue in the sanity phase, and only in the sense that that's an intentional act, too. To defend yourself, it's an excuse, but it's an intentional act that shows some mental awareness.
And the legal principle of whether an expert is required.
Yes.
Let me accept the proposition that an expert would necessarily be required, but can you have an insanity defense prevail when there are no third-party witnesses? Or, I mean, it's just the defendant's own, I'm crazy. All right, so
yeah,
I'm off.
I think that is a good point. I mean, there are ways to put on evidence of mental disease and defect without an actual expert. You can have mom, a friend, say that this is their history. They can bring in medical records. There was none of that. I would agree with Justice Rogan said that you need something, particularly in the second portion, to show that the person was not able to conform their behavior or appreciate right from wrong. I don't think it's enough to have just the witness himself to say, I couldn't do. Just conclusory testimony of that sort just wouldn't be enough.
But now,
enough.
Mr. Hinkle is going to be able to rebut this. Is he going to be able to stand up and say, look, this case and this case and this case show examples of where just the defendant alone can diagnose his condition?
I didn't find any. And I want to talk a little bit about that Sprague case, it's a 1971 case, and it's a case about epileptic seizures. And in that time, you know, first of all, it's an old case. We don't know if the medical evidence of epilepsy has changed, but at that time there were actual medical experts that said somebody in an epileptic seizure could, for hours and hours, appear like they were conscious and doing things intentionally, but the seizure would create an unconsciousness to it. You know, whether that's true or not, there was medical evidence there. They had brain scans of the person that showed that there were medical problems with his brain and that he had epilepsy. I think to take that case and expand it to the point where anything goes, that any allegation of blackout is enough, is just goes too far.
I want to follow up on that, because this court has better things to do than decide whether this individual defendant at an individual time under the individual facts of standing on his bed and having his fisticuffs up was telling the truth or not when he was relating the events. I mean, we've got other cases that are law development. Let's see if we can make this a little law development. You say that you need more than just the claim of blackout. What more do you need? What legal requirements?
Okay.
And would you include in that why you think this is a sufficient offer of proof, if an offer of proof is one of your legal requirements?
I think I'll start out by saying that the definition of mental disease or defect is very broad in the statute. But over time, the courts have carved out exceptions to that, so that right in the statute, there's an exception for antisocial.
I'm not asking how you would write the opinion. I'm asking what more do you need than the claim?
I think there needs to be, and it's all case by case. That's what's bothering me here. You know, and that is the law. You look at these things case by case.
You need an offer of proof.
Yeah, okay. If you are going to dismiss the claim before allowing the sanity, yes, I would say I would develop, and this is was a court-developed procedure in Kazi and Oswald. That wasn't anything in the statute. They developed this court procedure where the defendant needed to give an offer of proof that showed that they had some credible evidence of a mental disease and defect that caused them to not be able to conform their behavior and whatever. And I think that's an appropriate procedure. This isn't a criminal procedure so that the directed verdicts are okay. A quasi-summary judgment type of action like that, I think, would not violate any constitutional rights. And it is something that wouldn't necessarily have to be in the statute. Many of the things that now are in the statute were court mandated before they became codified. The bifurcated trial was, I think it was Raskin, developed that before they codified it. They, back in the old days, they gave the defendant the choice between the ALI standard or the McNaughton standard, and if they chose the ALI, then they said, well, then you have the burden of proof. Well, that got codified.
Ms. Ray, in response to the question, you said there should be an offer of proof. Well, the thing that bothers me in this record, there was no opportunity for an offer of proof.
I believe there was. I mean,
tell me where it is.
It is where maybe that's a different definition of offer of proof. They asked the attorney who was just about to start the sanity phase what she intended to
court. I'll try and read this. It's quite short. The court. What? I don't think that's the case law. She just says, Your Honor, I don't need a physician. It's a question for the jury. And then he says, what? I think that's the case law. I just got done reading the Leach case again, and you have to have some evidence. The counsel says, the evidence is what my client testified to. Court. You have to have medical evidence. Counsel. I don't think it says that. Court. You need to have some evidence that he's a mental disease or defect. Otherwise, what other? How can the jury just speculate? Counsel. Well, at the time of the incident, he said he blacked out. He doesn't have any remembrance. I think that fits the definition. Court. Of what? Counsel. Memory. He had a loss of memory. That's not a mental disease or defect. Counsel. Pardon? Court. That's not a mental disease or defect. Counsel. Yes, it is. Substantial disorder of thought, mood, memory, orientation, or perception. Do you agree that that can fit under the statutory definition? Substantial disorder of thought, mood, memory, orientation, or perception.
I believe if that's the Chapter 51 standard, that's not appropriate. And an NGI, and there's a case on that, and I'm sorry, I'm not sure which one of the cases.
Okay, so you just think that's wrong on the law.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it was Coput or, but there is a case that says Chapter 51 definition is not what's to be used in a.
Okay. The case says that even if you had an expert testify, a directed verdict could be issued for lack of proof. Because in this that case, they had a psychiatrist didn't testify. That would affect his judgment. And then they go on to discuss another particular case, and then the court discusses the burden of proof, and again, counsel says, I have my client's testimony, and then the court says he's not competent to testify, whether he has capacity. And that because he's not competent to testify, unless you're going to produce some evidence, I'm going to have to direct or dismiss the second. I'm going to direct verdict for the state on that issue. I'm looking for something to hang my hat on so we can have the second phase. But if you're not going to produce evidence that's competent, we can't move into the second phase. I don't see any evidence. Thought you're going to call Dr. Lewis. He goes on to about Dr. Lewis. So there's no evidence to sustain that plea. You're not going to produce any evidence. Therefore, you're not going to produce any evidence. I don't have a choice. Find no reasonable juror. So I have a couple of things about that. No evidence was produced. No offer to prove was produced. And the court is relying very heavily, if not totally, on the fact that you need an expert witness. Now, this is an this is the standard of review is erroneous exercise of discretion, right?
I would say that if we take the same standard for the directed verdict, that was whether he was whether the judge was clearly wrong, I think is the standard.
Well, the question would be, did he make an error of law or fact, being clearly wrong?
I don't think this was a discretionary decision, but
all right. So then you get to a legal decision.
Yeah. And
so what's the law that he's basing his decision on in this case? Now, we're not necessarily bound just to look at what the judge said.
Exactly.
We can look at the entire record, but you have to find something to support him, and he may have an error of law by not by saying, insisting you needed an expert.
I think it was an error for him to believe that they needed an expert for proving the mental disease or defect. I don't think that was the only reason that he dismissed the claim. I think he was saying there is nothing there that you can go forward with, and I think he was correct with that. And I think he was correct with that because I would call it an offer of proof. They were asked what they were going to put on in the sanity phase, and the attorney at great length, whenever questioned, said that we're going to replay the video and he's going to repeat the testimony that he had at trial. And there is nothing that indicates there was anything more than that. He didn't have any other witnesses. He didn't explain what he thought his defect or disability was in any broader terms. So, you know, the court gave the defense counsel every opportunity to explain that there was more, and there just wasn't more. She said no.
Does the transcript reveal a factual basis for the correctness or incorrectness of the Court of Appeals opinion at page 5, paragraph 8, where the Court of Appeals found that as the jury deliberated, the court turned its focus to the potential mental responsibility phase in the event of a guilty verdict in the first phase of the trial. The court asked defense counsel what additional evidence would be presented to meet Majette's burden of proof in the second phase. Defense counsel informed the court she would not be calling a court-appointed medical expert, Dr. Jonathan Lewis. Defense counsel also indicated that she would not call the defense's own medical expert to testify. However, defense counsel stated Majette would testify that he, quote, blacked out, end quote, and that he, quote, was out of it, end quote, for part of the confrontation. Now, does the record support the idea that the defense was given the opportunity for an offer of proof? And if so, is that an accurate summary of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an offer of proof, and I think that's an accurate summary of it. And I think the court was correct that if that's all that was going to be presented, there was no credible evidence that a reasonable jury could find that Mr. Majette suffered from a mental disease or defect and that he was unable to control his behavior. I mean, he said in his testimony, I'm willing to take the consequences. That's direct, uncontradicted evidence that he understood that what he was doing was wrong and that he was intentionally doing something to counteract that. So that, and that means that any suggestion that he blacked out or was out of it is just incredible as a matter of law. It conflicts with his uncontradicted testimony. It also conflicts with the rules of nature. So that I believe the court was absolutely correct in dismissing it. And I think a court can dismiss a claim when it is so. It's going to be the rare case.
I think one of the sticking points, though, in your argument, and it's been brought up by your opposing counsel and on questioning from the bench, is the issue of credibility. And as we all know, the issue of credibility is the exclusive province of the fact finder, here the jury. Why wouldn't? I know you've been asked about it, but I'm going to ask it point blank directly. Why isn't this a matter of credibility for the jury to decide?
Because the testimony that he said he was going to offer was incredible as a matter of law, and that's a legal issue. It's incredible because it conflicted with his allegation of blacking out, conflicted with his own conceded testimony of how he was aware during the time.
Okay, so in answer to Justice Prosser's earlier question about, well, could there ever be a case where someone says this, I think your answer then would be yes, because here you're not saying that it couldn't be a matter of credibility. You're saying because of the record that had been developed in his own testimony that it was incredible as a matter of law.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And I think this is an unusual case, and I think it will be the rare instance where a court will follow this procedure. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Prey. Mr. Hinkle?
I guess I'll start by saying I can't agree that if this court authorizes a trial court to dismiss an NGI plea without allowing evidence to be presented, it's going to be a rare procedure. I guess I just don't think that there's any evidence for that, and I think that it's likely that if this court says, hey, state, you can cut off these trials and not have to worry about a jury finding that someone's not mentally responsible, the state's going to be trying very hard to make that happen, and I think that it's likely to have a large impact. But turning to Justice Ziegler's question, you mentioned that the jury did, in fact, find beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Majette battered Officer Kaya with intent, and you asked whether that simply demonstrates that they were not going to believe Mr. Majette's testimony as far as the NGI, whether it's contradictory. I don't think it's impossible to intend and act in some sense while also being sufficiently out of it, having sufficiently impaired consciousness as to be unable to recognize its wrongfulness or as to be unable to conform to conduct.
I agree with you. I think you can have an NGI that can occur in an intent crime.
Okay.
So you don't have to go waste your time on that.
I mean, that's the whole basis of the bifurcated trial, in that you can find them guilty and then not find them guilty.
Absolutely, and a lot of evidence there.
I agree with Justice Ziegler. I would not spend my time on that.
Is there anything more in the record on this offer of proof? I'm looking at page 113 of the transcript. And this is where the court says... this is before the jury comes back in this in-between stage. The court says, if they bring back a verdict of guilty, we know what we're going to do. And the court had asked if she, the defense attorney, intended to call an expert witness. So I think this is the only offer of what is going to be proven, what she's going to offer as proof before the jury came back, and it's this. He presented his testimony that he was out of it during that period of time and in the video. So that's her offer of proof. Do you think that is a sufficient offer of proof? And if not, why not?
Yes, I do. I do think it's a sufficient offer of proof for the reasons that I've mentioned. Discussed earlier, that I do think that his own testimony about his own mental state and his own subjective consciousness is sufficient if the jury believes it. What was the second part of your question?
Well, I had heard your argument before saying that there really wasn't an offer of proof.
I guess the second part of the argument is...
I think this is it's a kind of a leading question in that I think this is pretty sparse. I come from a background of civil litigation, and boy, this would have to go for a sufficient offer of proof, I don't think. So I have a real question whether or not there was an offer of proof made. This is the only language that I find in the transcript that is the offer of proof before the jury came back. And after the jury came back, the only comments are that in response to this expert testimony need that the court was talking about, that no, there wasn't going to be any expert testimony, and that's on pages 119 of the transcript. And that essentially is at the top of 119, and this is more of a negative, it's not a positive. I understand, Your Honor, I don't have another expert under my wing. I had two experts who were appointed, but I don't believe they saw the whole case, but I don't have another expert. And then there's a comment by Ms. Anderson. The other one was for the public defender. And then there's a comment, again in response to expert stuff. No, Your Honor. And then the next page, there is a no, Your Honor, and another no, Your Honor. And so that's the offer of proof. Seems a little sparse to me.
Well, I guess I would agree. I mean, she certainly wasn't invited in any methodical way to present her evidence. And I would also point out, I think it was, I can't remember, it was 28, 38, something like that, minutes between the sending out of the jury initially and this conversation that you were just quoting from. During that time, she's apparently reading Leach. I think she said she didn't get all the way through it at some point. In addition, presumably, to, you know, possibly consulting with a client, I don't know, getting ready for the next phase of the trial, who knows? I guess I just, I don't think that the procedure that was employed by the court is the kind of procedure that's likely to create a record one way or the other on which the appellate courts can rule. And I don't think it's an appropriate way to run a trial, to run a jury trial, to deny someone the opportunity to testify and then say, well, we think, you know, we're kind of looking through the record and it looks like maybe you said, maybe you would have said this, maybe you would have said that, and hey, probably the jury wouldn't have believed you anyway, so it's harmless, end of case. I don't think that has a place in our criminal justice system.
So what's your argument on harmless error in three short sentences?
In three words or less, my argument on harmless error is essentially, I think, more or less what I just said. I mean, it's inappropriate where the theory of harmless error is that we don't disturb a jury verdict that's been returned if, based on some error, that, hey, we say, you know, this couldn't possibly have contributed to the jury's decision. When we don't have a jury verdict, to say instead, well, we don't think, given what we think the evidence would have been, that the jury would have returned a verdict in your favor. That looks a lot more like the courts simply taking over the role of the jury rather than, you know, protecting a verdict that's otherwise legitimate.
And his whole behavior could be viewed as not quite a sensible approach to his issues in prison.
Pardon?
I said his whole behavior could be viewed as not quite a sane approach to his position.
Mr. Majette's behavior?
Yes.
Well, yes. I mean, I don't. Counsel made the argument that his testimony about what was going on in his head was incredible as a matter of law in this case. I don't think that meets the standard under any circumstances. Certainly, given what you've just said about his general behavior, I don't think that we can say beyond a reasonable doubt that it's against the course of nature that Mr. Majette's discussion, his testimony about what was going on in his brain, runs against the course of nature, or that it's contrary to something that he conceded. It might be undermined, again, by his discussion of self-defense, or by the fact that, you know, he clearly was doing some things to encourage this confrontation.
Or the fact that he had testified the things that he recalled during the confrontation.
That he recalled portions of it, yeah. I think it's undermined. I agree. I don't think that it is contrary to conceded facts such that we can say that what was going on in Mr. Majette's head, as a matter of law, was that he was conscious and that he didn't have a mental disease or defect.
Mr. Hinkle, what What exactly is the remedy that you seek if you prevail?
In the instance that the court's decision not to hold the NGI phase of the trial is reversed, I believe it's in 971-165 that what happens is that it's remanded for the second phase only. The guilt verdict remains. So we'd be asking for a new second phase, the second phase that was never held to be held.
Okay. What would happen if defense counsel said, oh, I think I've come up with some new evidence?
You mean, you know,
can they say, as here, we're going to put on the defendant, we're going to put on the videotape, and that's what the judge made his decision on, presumably. Do you get to come up? Oh, I've found some experts here, and I've got other evidence now. Can you put that on?
I guess I don't see why that wouldn't be allowed. I mean, I don't think that giving Mr. Majette the opportunity to have a trial of something that I think he's entitled to a trial on, I don't think that means he's – I don't think there's any legal principle requiring him to be put in, that he not – that his counsel not have the opportunity to do the best job that they can.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank both counsel here for excellent briefs and argument in a NGI case. We haven't had one for quite a while, and this comes in a very different posture. So that ends our hearing in 10 AP 1639, State versus Maggott. The court will take a few minutes of recess to allow the court to clear people who wish to leave and allow counsel for the next case to enter the courtroom. We're in recess.